Targets included politicians, imams, and members of civil society. The assassinations took place in southern Yemen, in areas under the control of the internationally recognized government, and were traced to members of a private U.S. security company called Spear Operations Group. Before we speak with the BBC reporter who worked on the investigation, let's go to a clip from her report that includes the first on-camera interviews with U.S. mercenaries hired by the UAE for targeted killings in Yemen.
I'm going to fight the global war on terror. I'm going after bad people, evil people. When I get a chance to stamp out evil in this world, I love that. Sorry. I love hunting down bad guys and ending them.
Driving from the base down into a city was actually incredibly beautiful. There's this weird mix of excitement, fear, and also an odd serenity. We wanted to make a statement, hence the choice to use a detonator and a bomb.
I was actually surprised how dark it was. There were no lights. The roads were very tight and congested. You had people sitting on the street drinking chai. You had Al-Qaeda on every street corner. As soon as the vehicle stops, the doors open and it's showtime. We already started taking fire. There's people running. You can see the bullets bouncing off everything. Everybody deployed. I ran around the back and that was it.
Would you say that it was a successful operation?
Yes.
The U.S. military launched another airstrike in Yemen.
The U.S. and U.K. hit around 30 sites across Yemen.
This film is about the complex roles Western and regional powers have played in Yemen's war. And the story begins with an assassination mission.
Welcome. So that's your mic. Are you okay with putting it on?
I'm sure I can manage.
Okay.
I first met Isaac Gilmore in 2020. He's a former Navy SEAL who later became second in command of a private U.S. military firm called Spear Operations Group.
Yeah, me too. I want to be pretty.
I was surprised Isaac agreed to speak to me because, at the time, human rights lawyers were trying to prosecute Spear for war crimes.
When you make the choice to be involved in things that matter, you're not going to please everybody. There's plenty of people that would be happy to say that I was on the wrong side of something. One of the reasons that I agreed to participate in this and be part of this documentary is to be very clear about what we're doing and why. This isn't, innocent till proven guilty. It's war. And so you have intelligence, and then you make a decision to act on it.
An excerpt of the BBC investigative report on American mercenaries hired by the UAE to conduct assassinations in Yemen. We're joined now by the Yemeni-British journalist who conducted the investigation, Nawal Al-Marafi. She is a BBC Newsnight international correspondent and filmmaker. She's been reporting on the Middle East since 2012, joining us today from Amman, Jordan. Nawal, thank you so much for being with us. This is such an important investigation. Why don't you lay out what you found?
So basically, my investigation started at around 2015, really. I was in Yemen reporting from southern Yemen on the war that was going on there, on the humanitarian situation. But at the same time, I was hearing about these assassinations that were going on in southern Yemen, but no one knew who was responsible. And as the years went on, I kept hearing about these assassinations that were going on. There were rumored to be connected to, groups affiliated to the UAE, but no one could prove it. It wasn't until a BuzzFeed article came out at around 2018 that speaks about Spear Operations Group that we knew where to start, basically. So I reached out to Spear Operations Group, to their leader, Abraham Golan, to all the members, all the different mercenaries that worked for him. And surprisingly, some of them actually got back to me. And And that was our starting point. And from then on, it was a four-year investigation. It started by speaking to these mercenaries, talking about the operations that they were a part of, and then speaking to victims on the ground, speaking to people who were trained by Emiratis in Yemen. And so what we ended up finding was not only that Speer had conducted some assassinations, they trained Emirati soldiers who then trained Yemenis. And what we've seen is a systematic targeting campaign of, like you said, political activists, members of Al-Islah, civil society members. It's just created a climate of fear in southern Yemen.
So let's go to another clip from your documentary. This is from your interview with Ansaf Mayo, a Yemeni member of parliament, who's the leader of ISLA, who was one of the people, the mercenaries you spoke to, tried to assassinate.
I left the office half an hour earlier than usual, around 9:40 p.m. I arrived home and I heard an explosion. Moments later, some MPs called me. They asked if I was okay. I didn't understand. I told them I was fine. It turned out a statement had come out online. It said I'd been killed by a car bomb. That's how I found out I was the target. I hadn't realized until then.
How did you feel when you found out?
I felt afraid for my family.
3 years later, when the UAE's drone footage was leaked to the international media, Ansar found out that Speer had been hired to kill him.
What shocked me the most is that they'd sent foreign mercenaries to kill us in our own country. Why would they want to kill me? What moral and legal justification could there be to cross the ocean to kill me in Aden? Why? What am I guilty of?
Ansar fled Yemen after the attack and now lives in exile in Saudi Arabia.
So, Naval, if you could talk about what happened with him, why exactly he was targeted, and then at the end of the film where you tried to get one of the mercenaries, Isaac, to meet with him, he initially agreed to meet with him, but then didn't show up. Explain what happened.
So, I mean, you have two sides of Ansaf Mayo's story, right? You have the version that Isaac Gilmore and Dale Comstock tell us, the two mercenaries that I interview in the film. And their story is that they had, you know, Isaac tells us about going to the UAE, pitching this idea that they were going to help with the UAE's counter-terror campaign in southern Yemen. And they were given a pack of cards that had targets. They believed they were terrorists. They were told they were terrorists. And so they pursue what they call the head of the snake, the head of the terrorist organization. Now, this organization is Al-Islah. It is one of Yemen's biggest political organizations. It was founded in 1990. It's a Sunni Islamist movement. It's not a terrorist organization. And Ansaf Mayo was the leader of Al-Islah in Aden. He was their first target. Isaac tells us that they were told, you know, if you, you know, pursue this target and if you're successful in assassinating him, we'll then give you the contract to pursue other targets. So they say they do their own intelligence. They pursue Ansaf Mayo. It's their first operation. They go to the Al-Islah headquarters in Aden. They plant a bomb. There's shooting that happens. And they film this using a drone. you know, as they're doing it. And they believe in that moment that they were successful, that they'd killed Ansaf Mayo. But then you hear Ansaf Mayo's side of the story. You know, he had, and we also spoke to the people that were with Ansaf Mayo on that day. And they had a gathering. They were talking about music. He left a few minutes earlier before the building was attacked. And the eyewitnesses we spoke to told us they heard Americans outside the building, but they just couldn't believe what they heard. They couldn't believe that this operation involved Americans, so they just kind of let it go. And later, when the news story would come out and the drone footage would be leaked, they'd realize that, in fact, American mercenaries were involved in trying to assassinate Ansaf Mayo. When I interviewed Isaac Gilmore for the first time in 2020, he still didn't know that it wasn't a successful operation, that they actually hadn't killed Ansaf Mayo. I knew that because I'd had telephone conversations with us, Ansaf, and we were planning to do the interview. And so I really wanted him to not only, you know, find out that he wasn't successful, that Ansaf was, in fact, still alive, but I wanted him to meet him because he'd built up this idea that he was targeting this awful terrorist. And that was not the person that I got to know over the years in Ansaf Mayo. He is a really kind man. He is very kind of balanced in his views, a politician, a member of parliament, someone who has played a role in the peace process in Yemen with the United Nations. And so I didn't want Isaac to just hear it from me. I wanted him to meet him for himself. And Ansaf was totally up for it. And Isaac agreed to meet Ansaf. But unfortunately, even though he told me he had gone on his flight, he didn't come to London. And Ansaf was stood up.
And explain, these U.S. mercenaries, where they came from in the military, whether they're Green Berets, etc.
So it was a combination. So, for example, Isaac is an ex-Navy SEAL. So is Dale Comstock, but he's also a Green Beret. We also spoke to some French Legionnaires off camera. You know, we spoke to a few who had different backgrounds but didn't want to go on the record. It was only Isaac and Dale that agreed to go on the record.
They're paid like a $1.5 million a month for their assassination campaign.
Exactly. I mean, that's what we were told by Isaac. He said that they were, the offer they were given is if you're successful in assassinating Ansaf Mayo, the contract was $1.5 million a month. And then what we end up finding, you know, Isaac and Dale actually left Spear quite early on. They'd left Yemen at around 2016. And initially, when we first started this investigation, we thought that that's where it ended, that, you know, it wasn't very successful. And that was it. But then we found this financial document that we were told was from the UAE, and it had amounts that were transferred to pay for Spear Operation Group up until 2020. And so we felt like there was a part of the puzzle missing. We kept looking into what they could have possibly done after 2016. And that's when we found out about the training that Spear Operation Group had trained Emirati soldiers in these tactics. And then that went further on with Emirati soldiers then training Yemeni members of the counterterrorism section of the STC that would then carry out assassinations. And what we saw is as Emiratis trained Yemenis, there was an uptick in assassinations because it was even harder to pinpoint who was responsible for them when it was Yemenis carrying them out because they just blended in when they were, you know, on the streets. It was a lot more difficult for eyewitnesses to pinpoint who was responsible, especially in a place like Aden, which is so chaotic. You know, it's a war zone right now. It's really difficult to point a finger at who's carrying out these assassinations.
Okay, well, let's go to another clip of your report about this one about human rights lawyer Huda Al-Sarari, who investigated human rights abuses committed by the UAE-backed forces, who then targeted her son.
That day, I was at home. Mohsen went out with a group of friends. He was shot and wounded. Mohsen was shot from the front. It wasn't stray bullets or crossfire. It seemed deliberate.
After a month in intensive care, Mohsen died. He was 18. Eyewitnesses told the prosecutor that they recognized the gunman as a member of a counter-terrorism unit funded by the UAE. But nobody was charged.
After his death, I spent a long time at home grieving. After I went back to work, I started receiving death threats again. Haven't you had enough? Does your other son need to be killed before you back down? After that, I left Aden.
Who do you think was responsible for killing your son?
Those responsible for killing Mohsen and many other young men are those who are in charge of our security at the time, the UAE.
So that was a Yemeni human rights lawyer, Huda Al-Sarari. Her 18-year-old son was killed. Nawal, we'd like you to clarify whether you were able to conclusively establish that it was the Spear Operations Group that was responsible for his killing, and then talk, we just have a minute, about what kinds of cases are being brought against the Special Operations, the Spear Operations Group, since the group is registered in the U.S., is here where they should be prosecuted?
I believe so. I know that there are two human rights organizations who are working on a case against not only Spear Operations Group, but those who funded this type of, you know, warfare, basically. But one of the things we struggled with is figuring out the legality of their operations. You know, mercenary warfare is very new. It's a very gray area. It's not black and white when it comes to whether it's illegal or not. But Isaac seemed quite confident in saying that what they did was legal. You know, I did ask him whether Washington knew what they were doing. He said no, but he seemed to believe that the fact that they were working for a U.S. ally and that these were counterterrorism operations, in his view, meant that what they were doing was legal. And that's why he was quite open with us and happy to talk to us. But yeah. I don't have a clear answer for that one. I think it'll be interesting to see what happens next.
Well, we encourage everyone to watch the documentary. Nawal Al-Marafi, we want to thank you so much for being with us, BBC Newsnight international correspondent and filmmaker who's been reporting on the Middle East for over a decade. We'll link to your new investigation called American Mercenaries Hired by UAE to Kill in Yemen. Coming up on this first day of Black History Month, we speak to Dr. Uche Blackstock about Legacy, her new book, about a black physician reckoning with racism in medicine, back in 20 seconds. Every Land by 47 Soul. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Today, on the first day of Black History Month, we take a look at how racism shapes healthcare in America. A new book by Dr. Uche Blackstock explores systemic inequity in healthcare throughout the history of the United States up to today, as well as her own family history.
The book is titled Legacy, A Black Physician Reckons with Racism in Medicine. Dr. Uche Blackstock is an emergency medicine physician, CEO and founder of Advancing Health Equity, a company that works with healthcare organizations to fight racism and bias in services. She joins us today in New York. Dr. Blackstock, we spoke to you during the pandemic. We're speaking to you again today. The issue of health equity, or I should say inequity, is pervasive throughout the healthcare system in this country. If you can lay it out, but start off by talking about your family, your groundbreaking mother as a Black woman physician, you and your twin sister, the remarkable work that you've done, and why you're so motivated to take this issue on.
Well, thank you so much for having me. You know, I really wanted to write this book as a way to helping readers connect the dots about why in 2024 we have the worst racial health inequities, despite advances in innovation, research, and technology. So I used my own personal story, you know, being a second generation Black woman physician, which is something that unfortunately is still quite rare. My mother was the original Dr. Blackstock, graduated from Harvard Medical School in 1976, but was the first person in her family to go to college and then medical school, and then came back and returned to Brooklyn, New York, where she grew up to care for her neighbors and family, and practicing what's now known as health equity, organizing community health fairs, connecting residents to the social services that they needed, and working with other Black physicians and Black women physicians to do this work in service to their community. And so I use my mother's story and my story to really emphasize that how deeply embedded systemic racism is in our country, in the past and in the present, and to explain why even myself, as a Black woman with a college and medical degree from Harvard, I still am 5 times more likely to die of pregnancy-related complications than my white peers. So I wanted to use the history to explain why there are so few Black physicians today. And that's because of a report called the Flexner Report that we can talk a little bit more about. But I also wanted to explain how there are deeply rooted myths about Black people in this country, essentially biological essentialism, saying that we are different from other people. Even though we know race is a social construct, it really is racism through practices and policies that have harmed Black people in this country over the last centuries and have caused us to live shortened lives.
Dr. Blackstock, you mentioned the Abraham Flexner Report, and you said it's very important. Could you explain what it is and what impact it had on African Americans in medical schools in the early 20th century?
So absolutely. I thought it was very important for people to understand one of the reasons why there are so few Black physicians in the United States. You know, we're over 13% of the U.S. population, but we represent less than 6% of all physicians. And a lot of that has to do with this groundbreaking and actually very harmful report that came out in 1910 that was commissioned by the American Medical Association, which is the oldest and largest organization of physicians and has its own troubling history with bias and racism. American Medical Association and the Carnegie Foundation commissioned Abraham Flexner, who was an education specialist and also an avid racist. You can tell from his readings that I've included in the book, he believed Black people did not deserve to go to medical school. And if they were in medical school, they were there to help their white peers from getting sick. But anyway, he essentially assessed all 155 medical schools in the United States and Canada and held them up to the criteria of the gold standard, Johns Hopkins, at the time. And schools that didn't meet that standard were recommended to be closed. And as we know, because of the legacy of racism and slavery, historically, Black medical schools did not have the resources or the wealth or the endowments to really to live up to those standards. So this report in 1910 led to the closure of 5 out of 7 of the historically Black medical schools, which up to that point had trained about 1,500 students. But a report a few years ago actually estimated if those 5 medical schools had remained open, they would have trained between 25,000 and 35,000 Black physicians. And we know most likely likely they would have been black physicians, because Howard and Meharry, which are the medical schools that remained open, to this day, they still train the most black physicians out of any medical school in the country. But when we think about that number, 25 to 35,000 black physicians, it's a tremendous loss for our communities. If you can think of all of the hundreds of thousands or millions of patients, black patients that could have been cared for, the number of black students and trainees who could have been mentored, and the research in black health that could have been done. So this report in 1910 has had a tremendous and profound ripple effect on the worsening of health outcomes in our communities.
I wanted to ask you, Dr. Blackstock, about the horror of the remarkable four black women sprinters in the Rio de Janeiro Olympics in 2016. Years later, three of the women faced life-threatening pregnancy complications. One of them, Tori Bowie, died as a result of those complications. Two others, after she died, Tiana Madison and Allison Felix, spoke out about their life-threatening situation. You have the cover story of Vanity Fair, Serena Williams talking about what happened in terms of her life-threatening preeclampsia with pregnancy. Beyoncé, they have made this famous, but it means so many other black women. Why this disproportionate? I think of Erica Garner in our studio so many times, the remarkable young activist daughter of Eric Garner, who was killed by police. She dies after her second child was born at 27.
Yes. And so, you know, what is really, I think, very important for people to understand, and what I wanted to do with this book, is to really emphasize that, you know, there's nothing biologically wrong with black people. There's nothing inherently wrong with us, but there is something very wrong with the social institutions, not just healthcare within our country, that are deeply embedded with bias and racism. So to the point where often when we black patients interface with the healthcare system and health professionals, often our concerns are dismissed, ignored, and minimized, even if we are like Serena Williams, the greatest, one of the greatest athletes of all time. She talks about being ignored by her medical team, even after she had a history of a blood clot, telling them she was having similar symptoms, and her symptoms progressed. She almost died. But also, I want to also point out that for black people in this country, like, socioeconomic status, educational level of attainment, profession is not fully protective for us like it is for white people, because racism still causes what the public health researcher termed weathering. It still causes a chronic wear and tear on our bodies that causes us to prematurely age and makes us more susceptible to illness and disease. And so what I want people to understand when we see disease and illness in our communities, we see these racial health inequities. They actually are due to a result of upstream factors, like the fact that we live in a capitalist society, the fact that we live in a society where people don't have health care, universal health care, the fact that we live in a society with systemic racism, and that illness and disease that we see in black communities and other communities of color, but specifically in black communities, is a result of those upstream factors. So one thing I do with this book is I want to recommend to health professionals, academic medical institutions, policymakers, to think about health in all policies. So what's important is that not just that health professionals are able to adequately and competently care for black patients and listen to them and give them equitable care, but also that we understand how housing, how education, how employment, how access to quality health care, that also impacts how healthy our black communities are.
And so, Dr. Blackstock, if you could talk a little bit about your own experience as a healthcare professional, and the fact, of course, what you just said, the U.S. has among the worst, if not in the industrialized world, the worst maternal mortality rate. If you could just say, before we end, and we'll continue in the second part our conversation with you, your own experience working as a doctor.
Yes, you know, my own experience, you know, part of this book is also writing about my experience as a physician and being in environments where I myself, you know, as a black person, as a black woman, you know, in academic medicine, I felt very silenced. I felt muzzled. I was often questioned by my white patients about, you know, where did I go to medical school? You know, I was in environments that were actually quite toxic, racist, and sexist. And that is the case for so many of our Black physicians. Like, all we want to do is, most of us want to work in service to our communities. But I had gotten to the point where, you know, I realized it was too toxic, and I actually left academia. I don't want that to be the case for everyone.
Dr. Uche Blackstock, we're going to leave it there, but put the rest of the interview at democracynow.org. Her new book, Legacy. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
And now for a CJSF Heritage Minute. Simon Fraser University, the 1960s. In the earliest days of SFU, a renegade, unlicensed radio station begins broadcasting around campus. 1974. Volunteers establish the Simon Fraser Campus Radio Society, which operates CJSF to this day. 1985. The station obtains a cable license, bringing CJSF to a wider audience. And we've been changing the sound of radio in Burnaby ever since.
Hey folks, Joey K.